Now, I'm going to go out of order because I want to give this one aspect of this teaching which is important, and it's the teaching on obsession. But before I do this, does anybody have any question about anything that happened? Yes. Well, you don't know what happened 10 generations ago. Oh, you want me to repeat the question? Sorry. The question was about the blood lineage and inheritance. And what you were saying is that your family is not... Can I rephrase it? Of course you come from outer... We all come from outer space. We come from inner space. But then again, everybody comes from outer space. You know, so there's nothing new about that. But your real question is, how does it work? Because I'm so different from my parents. My parents are one way and I'm so different. Well, the human beings, you know, the question always arises, do we pick our parents? We, as this consciousness, do not pick our parents. We, as a soul, pick our parents. That's why people come together. They don't know why they came together, and suddenly there's a child emerging from this very bizarre union. And you think, well, how on earth did this happen? Because the soul, which is symbolized by what? By Cupid. This, which is innocent. That's the reason why Cupid is symbolized as a baby. The soul pulls together two people that it wishes to come through. And out of that union, the soul then creates its form, its accommodation. Now the soul is, remember I said, is not in any position where it knows good or bad. If it was choosing judgmentally, maybe it wouldn't have picked the parents that it picked. The soul only knows perfection. So it can see the two most miserable people in the world as totally perfect. You know, it doesn't look for qualities. It doesn't make lists. It doesn't say, oh, yes, I want to be born in the UK. They have some money. That'll make it more comfortable. And on what the soul looks for is not what we would look for. So you can't really blame it on the bossa nova. You know, blame it on your own soul. And this is why some children are born in very difficult circumstances. It's not for actions of the past, in a sense. It is that there has been just the ability to see what we would call terrible as beautiful. I mean, it's something that you can see in some plays that are tragedies. And you look at the tragedy, you look at that last scene in Romeo and Juliet, where they're the suicide, and you think, it's so ridiculous. You know, don't they get it? But you look at it, and by looking at that tragedy, you begin to understand something of the deeper nature of life at the subconscious level, not understand with the mind. For the mystic, tragedy and happiness are the same thing. Now, not intellectually and not experientially, but on the deepest level, it's an expression of the soul. It doesn't justify injustice, just so we're clear. We should not accept that which we know is patently absurd. But it does give some insight into life on Earth. I was talking yesterday to someone, and I said, you know, I don't know how people without some inner awareness stay sane in this world. If I didn't have some understanding, I could see how easily it would be to go absolutely insane, because it doesn't make sense. That's why this upsurge of materialism, which is bringing such destruction and greed, because we have no thread back to the light. And so it just gets progressively darker. Any other questions? Yes.
I have another blood question.
Yes. I didn't know blood was going to be such a hot topic. Yes.
So what happens?
It must be hot-blooded. What about organ transplants?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anybody know Moinuddin Jablonski? You know who he was? Moinuddin was the peer of Sirs, what was Sirs then, an order, a Sufi order that was founded after the death of Sam Lewis. And Murshid Sam designated Moinuddin as his successor. And Moinuddin, even when Murshid Sam was alive, had kidney failure. He lost one and the second one was going. It looked like he was going to die, and Murshid Sam went into his hospital room with his fudo stick, actually. He started beating on his bed and he said, you know, you did not come here to be a mattress tester. Now get out of this bed and start moving. And everybody was just astounded in the hospital. They were screaming, you can't do this. But he got better. He survived. And he lived for a number of years and then received a new kidney. And he received the kidney and everything was fine, and then the kidney went and he received a second kidney. When he got the second kidney, his entire personality changed. Really, this is someone very spiritually advanced. His entire personality changed. And he began to live out the impressions of that kidney. And it was quite a spiritual test for those around him. And fortunately, then the second kidney went and he got a third one and came back to himself. So what happens when you get blood transfusions? You absolutely take impressions from that blood. And what, interestingly enough, you know what impression we carry the most in the blood? The blood represents the earth, represents fear. So when people get a blood transfusion, I always suggest they do certain things to help work with their liver, especially to purify, because otherwise you can take in fears that aren't yours at all. But most of us live in worlds with minds that aren't ours. You think the thoughts in your mind are your own. Most of them are not your own thoughts. You pick them up from other people in the room. You pick them up from chairs, from, you know, you ride in the subway, you pick up impressions there. Everywhere you go, there are impressions. And if you don't know how to purify, then the impressions get built up like a layer of fertilizer and they grow things in them. And we get more and more confused. I mean, I said this yesterday, the first spiritual practice is purification. We need to know how to purify our minds every day. And just to finish this, because it has to do with the impressions we take in. When we say mind, we're talking about five functions. Most people, when they say mind, are just speaking about the function of thinking and reasoning. When the mystic speaks of mind, they speak of the first function, I'm using function loosely, which is the function in which the other four exist. What's the first function of mind? The heart itself. Then there's thinking and feeling, which is what we all call mind. Then there's memory. Then there is the ego, just a function of mind. And then there is willpower, the will. So that's the complete mind. So yes. No, you had a question. Oh, great question. The Druzi, and incidentally, the word Druzi is not what they call themselves. They had one leader once who was a terrible leader and sold them out to the British. And the British started calling them after this terrible leader whose last name was Druze. So life is very ironic. They call themselves the Mohideen, the people of the earth, really, the people of here. They definitely had a connection with the Gnostics. So did the early Kabbalists, you know, and so did certainly Jesus. And very interesting. I went to Qumran recently. That's where the Essenes were. Everybody know what the Essenes were? Well, there is this kind of romanticized, and I hope I don't insult anybody, churchified notion that the Essenes were these hermits and they were all celibate and it was just an order of men who, you know, and on and on and on. Well, they dug up the graves and they found that about a third of them were females and they were children. And you know what happened? This is really true. The church put pressure on the Department of Archaeology to stop the digs. And they did. So they didn't like what they were finding. But yes, the early Gnostics, who led they led lives of seclusion, that was real. They were a spiritual community. They gave some of their transmission to the Druze. So, and the other question? Yes, yes and no. Maybe it's different, maybe it isn't. You know, the reason that they make these images of the Buddha in gold, it's the right thing to do because it represents the light. That's gold, always is a symbol for light. And the awakening is the experience of the this is a narrow definition, but of the infinite light in the finite us, I am awakened. And in the language of the Sufis, when we say awakening, we are saying that it is God awakening to itself, which is the same thing as the anointed one, the awakened one. So I wasn't going to bring this up. I was going to tell you privately, but I'll tell everybody publicly. In 1910, the first Zen master came to the West. His name was Shaku Soyin. And he was, if you ever get a chance to see a picture, it's beautiful. He looked like a woman. And he had a perfect face, absolutely perfect. Every feature was so fine. And the first Sufi master came to the West, Hazrat Inayat Khan. And they both were connected to UC California at Berkeley. They each knew somebody on the faculty there, the Department of Psychology, which had a faculty of two at the time. And so one of them set up this luncheon in the typical kind of post-Victorian way of, well, we'll have a proper luncheon. And so the two professors and the two mystics sat down and had this luncheon together. And the professors naturally asked questions for about an hour. And then the two mystics said, "Will you excuse us? We want to sit together for a moment." And they said, "Of course." So the two of them sat down for 5 hours. And they didn't say a word. At the end of 5 hours, they both got up laughing. Shaku Soyin said, "Mr. Inayat Khan, I see Zen in you." Inayat Khan said, "Mr. Shaku Soyin, I see Sufism in you." End of meeting. So, you know, Sufism and Zen is quite connected, not just on the inner planes, but in in China and in what's now Pakistan, there are Buddhist statues with Sufi inscriptions on it. Not from the era of Rumi, from well before that, from right past the time of the Prophet. And the Prophet said this interesting thing. He said, "Seek ye knowledge all the way to China." He could have said all the way to Hoboken, but he didn't. He said all the way to China. He was saying something. There is this connection. The connection between the paths is so much more real and historic than any path really wants to almost admit. It's quite fascinating when you start finding the connections. I was in a Zen monastery in Japan, and an old, old man came up to me, and he said, "I heard you're a Sufi." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I knew Shakusoyen, and he told me about Anayat Khan." And he said, "Let me tell you," when he told me this beautiful, not this story, but he was talking about his consciousness and his realization and so on. So the connections are there. Really, they're really real. And for myself, we're talking about different impressions. I know that as deeply as impressed as I was with Sufism on my journey in so that I could do my work, at another level, I was, I won't say more deeply, but equally deeply impressed with Buddhism, because I know that I just know things, you know, and there's only one way you can know these things. So we have these streams in us, especially mystics, especially when you, the people in this room, start doing your work, then these streams begin to automatically uncover themselves. And you find out really what's in there. So I'm not too concerned that we perfect our lives. Life is very short. I'm concerned that we live our life as a human being. That's very important. And it's odd. People ask me all these questions, and to me it always boils down to one thing, which sounds so narrow, but I always ask myself at the end of the day, were you kind? Were you a kind person today? And I look at my day. And more important than spiritual states and spiritual experiences, and that is the fundamental experience that makes a human being divine. Are you practicing kindness? Now, it might not look it, but you'll know when you're kind and you'll know when you're not kind. So... I'm going to go on. I know there's one more question, if you can hold it, because it's important that you understand, even intellectually, this teaching of obsession. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into the Sufi Book of the Dead, what happens to you when you die and what that journey is like. What we should be doing with bodies, what we should be doing with impressions and so on when people die. If you really are interested, at some time in the spring, I believe it's in March, I have a 5-day closed teaching about death and dying that I do. And I limit it to a certain number of people, and you can... If you want to find out about it, when it is, you can go to a website called Rising Tide International. No, is that what we're called? I think so. Rising Tide, I never go to the website. It's either Rising Tide International or, yeah, it is, risingtideinternational.org. Fortunately, I have other people who do the org part. I'm not very good on the org. And you can find out about the schedule, and if you go to Shahabuddin's calendar, you'll see which part of the globe I'm in. It's risingtideinternational.org. If you don't find it, just put Shahabuddin Less into any search engine and there's some stuff you'll find me.
There's a link from this website too.
From the website, you can go to the calendar, right?
Yeah.
I hope.
There's also links.
Oh, from this website?
To your...
Oh, great. Well, there you are. There you are. So you can find it. One of the roles of the Sufis traditionally is to teach people how to die, because Sufis are always working with death. Sufis actually enjoy death. They use it as a spiritual teacher. You know, what was his name? Carlos Castaneda. Remember, he wrote all those spiffy books with all the, you know, things happening. Well, when you read books like that, you have to pick out the gems. And one of the gems that was in there is to use death as an ally. That's what Sufis do. They use death as a spiritual teacher. For us, death is always coming. Sufis joke about death, and they invite death, and they laugh about death, and they respect death, too. And death becomes the teacher. And St. Paul must be here today. Remember he said, I die daily? What he was saying was, I am aware every day, and I make the transition every day. I lose this limited bodily consciousness every day. Very misunderstood guy, poor St. Paul. Really, very misunderstood. What's the saying? God, please protect me when I try and do good and it invariably turns out bad. St. Paul. When we leave here, if we are prepared, even reasonably prepared, and that preparation can occur in the last breath, when we leave here, we will leave here. We will know that the journey continues. We will know that the direction is away from manifestation. And we'll move. Our energy will begin the next part of an incredible journey. And don't worry, it lasts a long time, sometimes too long. But it really goes on and on and on. You die in one world, you're born in the next, you die in one, you're born in the next, on and on. Thousands of worlds, thousands of experiences. You know, but this is the culmination, believe it or not. This is the zenith. Many people who have no sense of harmony. I'm not talking about religion. Religion doesn't necessarily give you a sense of harmony. Many people who have no sense of harmony, many people who are filled with fear, many people who are filled especially with greed and detachment, when they leave here, they're very confused because their whole consciousness is still attached to here. And when you die, it's not like you're dead. You have a form, your form, you have a name, your name. It's like a dream. So you're thinking, well, I'm still here, and you have an awareness of the earth. This room is filled with beings. It's not just us in here. It's crowded. There aren't enough chairs for the amount of beings that are in here. Because there's spiritual energy in here. And so many, many are drawn. If you have no direction, if you think, I don't want to leave the earth, I like this, I love that, then you go into a world of confusion that you create. It's not somebody else's world, it's not something outside of you, it's you and your confused mind. Remembering that the mind is not just thinking and feeling. The mind is memory. If you don't know how to purify the memory, for example, the memory will pull you back. The mind is willpower. You need to direct the will in that direction, not back here. And the mind, as I said, is ego. If the ego is attached to here, it's not so easy to live in heading out. You want to be here. And what makes it worse is if you have relatives who are saying, oh, Joe, please don't go, please don't go. Imagine if you leave here tomorrow and all 300 people are standing in the driveway saying, no, no, don't go, and they're throwing themselves in front of your car and all. You know, it's a hard journey. And yet that's exactly what happens. We don't know how to go and we don't know how to let go when we're on the earth. And many of us die in hospitals. And who are in hospitals? Doctors and nurses who are afraid of death. So there's more confusion. The journey gets more unclear. When you leave here, leave. Be thankful and leave. Not be thankful that you're gone. Be thankful for your life. Be thankful for the opportunity. And have the courage to leave. For those who don't leave, the room really is crowded. For those who don't leave, they can only experience things of the world through a human being that is alive on the earth. They can see the world, but they can't feel it except through your eyes, your ears, your body, and to some extent your mind. So they're in a confused state. They find human beings who are in a weakened state, in a confused state, and they project their consciousness through those human beings, and those human beings are living their own life and the life of another being who is confused. Don't have this notion that just because a being is non-physical that they're in a higher or clearer state than you are. You know, don't think that it just goes like that, that and the lowest level is the body. The body is the temple of God, and we need to clean it out. And what does that mean? It means purifying it of other beings. So many people that we say have multiple personality disorders and so on, they're obsessed. There are other beings living there. And it's not often quite so blatant. It's a very subtle thing. It is incumbent upon us as human beings to do spiritual practices for purity, for clarity, and also to know how to direct those beings that are confused when they come to us and want to come through us. Now, there's positive obsession and there's negative. What's a positive obsession? You know, if I don't really know something, you ask me a question and I don't have a clue. I have not experienced that yet. I'll just simply allow one of the great beings who usually know everything to obsess me. And you'll all think, oh, what a wise person Shahabuddin is. I wish I could take the credit. I just had enough smarts to get out of the way. You know, the universe is infinite. All that we need to know is here, if we just can get out of the way. So the Sufis call it fana, annihilation, but it's a concentrated annihilation. It's fanafi, annihilation where? Or annihilation in. In what? Well, you annihilate in a great being, perhaps, that's gone before, or a great being that's going to come in the future. And you let them use you. Now, the great thing about great beings is they never misuse you. And so if you really practice fana in a teacher, then that teacher speaks through you. I mean, we all can see that happen. People love their teacher. When the teacher goes, the teacher doesn't go. One of my teachers was Joe Miller. Anybody ever meet Joe Miller or know of him? You knew of him, and two met him. He just died 10 years ago. Joe was this wild, wild guy. He was, as a young man, he was a singer in burlesque theaters. He used to sing behind the strippers. And he said, I used to stay in one theater until I had made love with every one of the women, and then I'd go to another theater and get another job. He was outrageous. He said, one day I stood on the roof in San Francisco, and the voice of the universe spoke to me. He said, my whole life was changed in a moment. And he never became holy, by the way, but he awoke. Whatever that means, he really awoke. And there was a great experience where His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, was in San Francisco and with this very prestigious group of people up on a dais, you know, and he came off the dais, went right down to Joe Miller. He said, "This man knows more about Buddhism than anybody ever born in the West." And he said, "Probably born in the East too." And I was in a temple in Tibet, one of these temples. It was just when they opened it, and it was pitch black, and it wasn't pitch black. They had the butter lamps, and you could just barely see things. And I had my flashlight, which I snuck in, and for some reason, and I shined it on one of the statues of the arhats, and it was Joe's face exactly. You know what the arhats are? The beings, 18 beings that came with the Buddha. I think, is it 18? Do you know? So I think it's 18. But the incarnation of the different ways of oneness. Anyway, and Joe said, the last time I saw him, I said, "Is this it? Am I never going to see you again? Are you going to just die?" And he said, "Yeah, this is it." And my wife and I were there, and he said, "But don't worry." He said, "I am going to be in your hearts for real. You will never be able to get rid of me." And he died, and it's been totally true. Whenever I need anything in that regard, I can just go, you know, to the, okay, and there he comes. So, but we have to know how to empty ourselves before we can be filled. Fana means annihilation. Baka, the second half, it's fana and baka. Baka is resurrection. There is no resurrection without the annihilation. Certainly the master on the cross was teaching this. First the annihilation, then the resurrection. So in order to annihilate, we need to purify. In order to purify, we need to know that we are a receiving ground for a multitude of spirits and thoughts. Not just spirits, other people can obsess us too. Now we're afraid of the word obsession because of the movies and because of the connotation it has and because of the disorder, which is usually not from a person being obsessed, but we call it, you know, OCD and whatever. But obsession is something that the mystic must learn about. Because as you negate the nafs, as you negate a very strong sense of self, if you are not conscious, you can open yourself to terrible obsessions. This is why you see great spiritual teachers suddenly, you know, chase an 18-year-old secretary. And you think, what? Oh, this terrible person, and on, and there's a scandal, and everybody leaves. And in order to do the work, you must be very receptive. When you're very receptive, if you're not conscious of this skill, anything can come in, darkness as well as light. The path really is the razor's edge. Because the compassionate person on one hand wants to let in the darkness. You know, I fall for it all the time, and I pay the price. I see beings suffering. And my wisdom is, this is not your dharma. This is not what you're here for, this person. They'll be all right. Let go. My ego can't do it. I feel their pain. And I'm training myself, I'm getting better. But it's a very difficult thing. And there is a balance. That's why I said before, right at the beginning, the duality is love and power, really. Or the Sufis say it's they pick an odd two things. They say it's peace and joy. Those are the two poles. Peace and joy. And then they say all tragedy, all tragedy, all revolution, all famine, all war, all everything comes from the conflict of peace and joy. Now, I'm not going to explain that, but you can think about it for a while. It's very interesting if you think about it. So, I don't care what practices you do. spiritual practices have the odd traits of working if you do them. You know, even if you do them half right, they'll work. But they also do not work if you don't do them. So it doesn't matter what practice you do. It doesn't matter to me. I find that they work. And the nature of practices is to purify us and to make us strong enough to do the spiritual work. You know, you need a body that's strong enough. You need a mind that's strong enough to do the spiritual work. Many times in meditation you can come up to an energy that's just swirling. And somehow you have to keep your center and absorb that. And you need some strength to do this. You need to be seated on the ground to do this. So who gets obsessed? Well, people who are suffering from physical diseases, have high fevers, they start hallucinating. Why? They don't have the power to maintain themselves, their very self. When we go on chilvat, Sufis go on retreat. Sometimes you go on long retreats. I went on a really long retreat. You eat very little, you're living alone, and you begin to recognize other beings that come in. And if you're not strong enough, it's quite a struggle. And you know, it can be an angel. It doesn't have to be a demon. Jacob wrestled with the angel, not with a demon. And it was in the end of the night that he won. And then what happened? What did the angel do? The angel changed his name, changed his nature, because he began to have the awareness of the inner as well as the outer. That's what that story is all about. What did he change his name to?
Israel.
Yeah, Israel, one of the great names of God. So, in this case, make sure that you're aware of what thoughts in your mind are your own and what thoughts are not. And you can become aware by looking. Don't accept every thought that is in your mind as your thought. Just begin to feel what your thoughts feel like. How do you feel your thoughts? Connect them to your own heart. The heart doesn't lie, the mind lies all the time. Making the mind authentic is part of our work. How do we do it? Connect it with the heart. The heart only knows truth. Now, the covering of the heart, as we say, can become rusty. That's why, illallah, 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 ill. You know, we're getting rid of the rust all the time, polishing that mirror. If you don't want to do zikr, I'll give you a practice everybody can do. When you take a shower in the morning or whenever you take a shower, you just take your hand, your right hand, you put it on your heart center. Now, Sufis have three heart centers, the physical heart, the spiritual heart, and the sir, the secret, right in the middle. You put your hand right in the middle and you make a motion just like this. Just a nice round circle. And as you do that, you go, ah, ah, ah. At least it's a start. It'll help bring the coverings away. You don't have to do fancy practices. Simple ones work. And if you want to put a la in there, that's all right too. Allah, Allah, Allah. So, when you know your own thoughts, then your experience of walking down the street becomes quite different. Because you walk down the street, you feel thoughts come in. And when you feel a thought come in, you can just put it to rest. This brings me to the end of the talk. The part about putting it to rest. This is the culmination of the whole 2 days. What is the future comprised of? The future of humanity is made up of the unfinished impressions that die with us, that we pass on to the incoming generations. This is what it means when it says in the Bible, the sins of the fathers shall be visited upon the sons. This is understanding karma. If you take this with you, if you take this impression of confusion, of fear, of greed, of doubt, if it's still who you are, where your heart is, there your treasure is also. If you take that with you, you will pass that on to the next generation. And it will be incarnated again and again. And this planet will not evolve. If you really are a compassionate being, and I believe that you and we are, then know that what work you're doing on yourself will help the overall evolution of the planet, because when we die, we will pass on a very clear map of what this place is like. We will pass on very wise guidance on how to function here, and we will pass on emptiness rather than confusion. If we can pass on emptiness, the human being, this perfect creation, will know what to do with it. The problem is when we pass on confusion. Remember, the bulk of another being is going to be what you give them. You, each of you, will be the spiritual teacher for at least one being. And that one being could be a very critical being. And maybe what you'll pass on to 100 or 1,000 or more. When Sri Ramakrishna died, he said he was going to pass his essence on to 1,000,000 souls at least. At least. So, if we care, then we will learn how to live consciously and die consciously, and we'll practice death, so we'll know how to go quite consciously. It won't be a strange experience for us at all. Could you do me a favor and just hand me that one? I'm afraid I'll come, no, the other one, careening off the chair if I do this. Last thing about the Druzi, the Muhyiddin. When I was with this Druzi sheikh, I did a universal worship service. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this service, but there's a candle lit for many of the religions of the world, and behind them there's one big candle which represents the light that comes through all religion, and in the front there's another candle which represents all those, whether they were known or unknown to the world, who've held this light of truth aloft. And we always add the native religion of the country, so when we do it in North America, we do the Native American religion, and we can add whatever religions you want, quite frankly. But there is no way to distinguish any one candle from the other. There is no candle that is culturally different. The service has no culture, in a sense. And it is pure. And then we read, if we choose to, from the scriptures of the different religions. And many times we read in the original language, so you don't understand the words, but you hear the sounds. And it's quite a beautiful service. Well, this last time when I was in Israel, and I was visiting Abu Rukun, the Druzi, and at the end we he had some other sheikhs come, and they told me their teachings, and then I talked to them for 20 minutes about some of what I talked to you about, and they were just astounded. They said, "People know about this?" I said, "Yeah, people are learning about this." And so then the sheikhs left, and it was just with Abu Rukun, and I said, "Let me show you this service, because you can do the whole thing in 10 minutes. And I showed him the service, and he said, "You know, I knew in my soul that something like this existed on this planet, but I never thought I would see it." So there's things coming. I mean, we have every reason to be hopeful. So on that note, I'll read you these five lines about death. Death takes away the weariness of life, and the soul begins life anew. Death takes away the weariness of life, and the soul begins life anew. Death is a sleep from which the soul awakens in the hereafter. Death is a sleep from which the soul awakens in the hereafter. Think about that word, hereafter. Death is the crucifixion, after which follows the resurrection. Death is the crucifixion, after which follows the resurrection. Death is the night, after which the day begins. Death is the night after which the day begins. It is death which dies, not life. It is death which dies, not life. There is one final one. The life everlasting is hidden in the heart of death. The life everlasting is hidden in the heart of death. So, thank you. There are three prayers that we say morning, noon, and night. When we ended yesterday, we said the prayer Khatam, which is the one we say at the in the night. But I'd like to say the noon prayer, which is a beautiful prayer. It brings in all the prophets, all the known and unknown, not all the prophets, it mentions prophets. And also it mentions the mother and the father and the child and the teacher. It's the prayer of the oneness, the all-pervading oneness of God. So if you know it, join me, and if you don't know it, listen. And I brought, someone very graciously typed up all three, or printed all three, and I have two copies if anybody wants to make copies. I don't know if there's a copy machine here. But if you want these, they're very beautiful prayers. So I'll just hang on to those. If anybody wants, they can pick them up. You know, I think I'm going to do the first prayer, if you don't mind, the one we do early in the morning. It's a lot easier getting out than getting in. Give me a moment. I have to stand to do this, and I'm not quite ready. Forgive me for changing again, but I'll do the second prayer. Towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Most gracious Lord, Master, Messiah, and Savior of humanity, we greet Thee with all humility. Thou art the first cause and the last effect, the divine light and the Spirit of Guidance, Alpha and Omega. Thy light is in all forms, Thy love in all beings, in a loving mother, in a kind father, in an innocent child, in a helpful friend, in an inspiring teacher. Allow us to recognize Thee in all Thy holy names and forms, as Rama, as Krishna, as Shiva, as Buddha. Let us know Thee as Abraham, as Solomon, as Zarathustra, as Moses, as Jesus, as Muhammad, and in many other names and forms known and unknown to the world. We adore Thy past. Thy presence deeply enlighteneth our being, and we look for Thy blessing in the future. O Messenger, Christ, Nabi, the Rasul of God, Thou whose heart constantly reaches upward, Thou comest on earth with a message, as a dove from above when the Dharma decays, and speakest the word that is put into Thy mouth, as the light filleth the crescent moon. Let the star, the divine light shining in Thy heart, be reflected in the hearts of Thy devotees. May the message of God reach far and wide, illuminating and making the whole humanity as one single family in the parenthood of God. Amen. So thank you all for coming. Bless you all. I'm happy to meet you.